that Canadians have in mind when they think about their urgent day-to-day needs. And I think there's been a lot of talk from Carney about how, you know, their military spending will break Canada away from its dependence on the U.S. Carney himself has acknowledged that 75% of our current military spending goes to the U.S. military-industrial complex. 40% of Canadian weapon companies are themselves just U.S. branch companies. So there's a lot of, I think, kind of talking out of both sides of their mouth, because at the end of the day, if they want to build with this speed and this amount of money, it is inevitable that Canada will still be sending so much of that money to U.S. companies to build the weapons that they say they now want.
There's a highlight from a new episode of The Breach Show. Listen to the rest of the interview wherever you get your podcast at harbingermedianetwork.com. And find more at Journalism for Transformation at breachmedia.ca. You listen to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. Coming up next. Since launching in May 2023, Perspectives, the Broadbent Institute's Journal of Political Economy and Social Democracy, has brought left-wing thought and inquiry into public debates and policy for building a more just and equitable Canada. On this excerpt from a new episode of the show's new segment, Social Democrats of the North, host Dave McGrain explains how, amidst working-class poverty and the upheaval around the First World War, Olivier Asselin emerged as a Montreal journalist advocating for Quebec's working poor. Now, here's the show.
Hi, and welcome to Episode 3 of Season 1 of Social Democrats of the North, presented by the Broadbent Institute's Perspectives Journals podcast. I'm your host, Dave McGrain, professor of political science at St. Thomas More College at the University of Saskatchewan, and member of the Perspectives Journals editorial committee. From Confederation to the Quiet Revolution, Social Democrats of the North takes you on a journey through history to discover the lives and ideas of the leaders who have shaped Canadian social democracy. It illustrates the importance of social democracy to the history of Canada and gives you some tips for your own activism. In the last two episodes, we looked at historical figures who were prominent social democratic leaders in the time period from the creation of Canada in 1867 to the end of the 1800s. In this episode, we are going to move into the 1900s. We are going to start off our examination of the history of Canadian social democracy in the 20th century by looking at someone who had a life full of surprising twists and turns. But he persevered through it all and ended up making a vital contribution to Canadian history by solidifying the linkage between Quebecois nationalism and social democracy. I'm talking about one of the most famous journalists in Montreal at the beginning of the 1900s, Olivier Asselin. But before we get into what Asselin was up to in the early 1900s in Montreal, we have to explore a bit of his unique family history. Olivier Asselin was born in a very small rural Quebec village in 1874. His first name was quite uncommon and reflected the radical liberal thinking of his parents. Olivier is actually a contraction between traditional French-Canadian name of Olivier and Bolivar, which is the last name of a famous South American revolutionary. Soon after his birth, Asselin's family became embroiled in a local controversy that generated headlines in newspapers around Quebec. His father was a working-class guy. He was a tanner, which meant that he turned animal skins into leather. Reflecting his liberal thinking, Asselin's father testified against the Catholic Church in a trial where his very own priest was accused of intimidating voters to get the local conservative candidate elected. Testifying against your own Catholic priest wasn't going to make you very many friends at the end of the 1800s in rural Quebec. After the trial ended, the Asselin family was harassed so badly by local Catholic clergy and local Conservative Party members that they were forced to move away and set up a tannery in another town. When Olivier Asselin was a teenager, he experienced more bad luck when his father's new tannery burnt down. Asselin was struck with the feeling that as he watched his father's tannery go up in flames, his future was going up in flames with it. At the time, Asselin was an outstanding student at the local college, and he was constantly impressing his teachers and his classmates with his creativity and leadership skills. He had even earned the nickname the Little Corporal, the same nickname that had been given to Napoleon by his soldiers. But Asselin's family misfortune meant that there was no money to pay for his schooling, and he was forced to abandon his studies. He had to move, along with his father and other relatives, to Fall River in Massachusetts in 1892. At the time, Fall River was a French-speaking community where men who could not find work in their Quebec hometowns toiled for hours at low pay in factories owned by rich American businessmen. Asselin went to work in a cotton mill with the rest of the men in his family. He started to experience very harsh poverty. especially during the bitterly cold Massachusetts winter when his family could not afford to buy enough wood to heat their home. At this point in his life, Aslan did not have very many good prospects. It seemed like he would probably become a worker, like his father, and live out his life in poverty in the United States, far from his Quebec homeland. But then something happened that changed Aslan's fate. One day, he was rummaging around in the basement of a local church, and he happened onto a pile of old newspapers from France. He started to read through the newspapers and discovered they were full of articles on politics written by famous French pamphleteers. Then it struck him like a bolt of lightning. He was going to become a journalist and write stories that would bring attention to the plight of poor French workers. He had finally found a calling that matched his passionate, proud, and fiercely independent personality. So he began sending stories talking about the poverty of French workers to the French language newspapers of Massachusetts. Just a little context here. Objective and unbiased journalism was not in vogue in the late 1800s. Journalists were expected to give their opinion and to advocate for the ideas and causes that they believed in. Aslan used his capacity for independent thinking to do just that. He finally got his break in 1894 when he was hired by the French newspaper of Fall River to cover municipal affairs. Aslan decided to use his newspaper articles on municipal affairs to chronicle the stories of extreme poverty of the workers in Fall River. He even shared his meager $12 a week salary with many of the poor who he met and wrote about. In 1900, Aslan moved to Montreal to continue to chase his dream of becoming a famous journalist who would shed light on the poverty of the working class. It is in the time period from 1900 to 1915 that Aslan made his most notable contributions to Canadian social democracy. This is a time period in Quebec that was characterized by the emergence of left-wing working-class politics and the growth of French-Canadian nationalism. Aslan's journalism gained him fame by marrying these two things. First, I will talk about Aslan's left-wing working-class politics, and then we'll talk about how he fit that working-class politics with his French-Canadian nationalism. Soon upon his arrival to Montreal, Aslan joined the St. Vincent de Paul Society and took on the role of a social worker, helping unhoused people in the downtown area. His journalism began to reflect his experiences as a social worker. His newspaper columns denounced the selfishness of business owners who make ever greater profits for themselves while there are people literally starving in the streets. He was particularly scathing in his critique of the English, Canadian, and American owners of large companies operating in Quebec. Aslan's journalism uncovered how they were making enormous profits off the extraction of Quebec's natural resources while leaving French workers employed by them in horrible poverty. Aslan's solution to solving the problems of French workers in Quebec was straight-up social democracy. He called for high taxes to be levied on rich businessmen. With revenues from these taxes, he said the Quebec provincial government could do three things. It could create social programs like pensions, healthcare, public education, unemployment insurance, and social assistance to reduce the poverty of French workers. It could also establish new government-owned companies to provide essential goods and services such as housing, water, electricity, telegraphs, and railways. These essential goods and services would be provided at prices that all citizens could afford. Finally, he called for the government of Quebec to organize and sponsor forestry cooperatives that would be owned by Francophone workers. These worker-owned cooperatives would reduce the dominance of Quebec's forestry industry by American and English companies, and they would pay their workers decent wages. The business and political elites of Quebec didn't take too kindly to what they considered to be Aslan's radical social democratic ideas. Indeed, they sued him for libel several times over what he wrote in his newspaper articles. He fell into financial hardship as his legal bills piled up, and he was sent to jail in 1907 when he couldn't pay up. He then gets in trouble again in 1909 when his passion really got the best of him. He was covering the provincial legislature in Quebec City as a journalist. When the Minister of Labor was spreading what Aslan considered to be falsehoods about a newspaper article Aslan had wrote, Aslan came down from the press gallery to the floor of the legislature and slapped him in the face. He ended up being sent to jail again, this time for assaulting a public official. As I mentioned, Aslan was not only a social democrat, he was a French-Canadian nationalist at the same time. What I mean by a French-Canadian nationalist is not necessarily someone who wanted Quebec to separate from Canada. Rather, the French-Canadian nationalism that was prominent in the earliest 20th century in Quebec generally wanted more power to be given to the Quebec provincial government. It advocated giving more power to the Quebec provincial government to ensure the survival of the French language and prevent the assimilation of Francophones into the broader English, Canadian, and American culture that surrounded them. Along with Henri Bourassa, Aslan founded the Ligue Nationaliste, or the Nationalist League, in 1903, and the newspaper Le Devoir, The Duty in 1910, both intended to promote French-Canadian nationalism. In terms of his French-Canadian nationalism, Asselin believed that French Canadians were their own unique race that was separated from English Canadians by their language, traditions, and their Catholic religion. This belief meant that he was against Canada being part of the British Empire. Asselin and the Nationalist League also held some very racist views about the biological superiority of what they considered to be the great Latin race of Europe. And they were very wary of letting immigrants into Canada who did not speak French. Overall, his nationalist views led Asselin to advocate two things in particular. First, he argued that more power should be given to the Quebec provincial government to control immigration. And that meant that there'd be more French-speaking immigrants led into Quebec. And second, he claimed that the Quebec provincial government should be given more power to ensure Francophone control of Quebec's economy, as opposed to having Quebec's economy being controlled by American and English-Canadian businessmen. Asselin eventually had a falling out with Bourassa, who fired him from the Devoir, and Asselin was again in serious financial trouble. He tried his hands at politics during this time and unsuccessfully ran in the 1912 federal election as a Nationalist Labour candidate. He then found himself pressed into the presidency of the Société Saint-Jean-Baptiste de Montréal, the St. John's Society of Montreal, in 1913 and 1914. And this turned out to be a good thing for him. In this role, he gained fame throughout Quebec by organizing a fundraising campaign to contribute towards the survival of the newspaper Le Droit. Le Droit had been published in Ottawa since 1913. It consistently championed the rights of Francophones in Ontario, which were under attack by the conservative provincial government at the time that was trying to ban the use of French in Ontario's public school system. Asselin's campaign raised $15,000, and that was enough to guarantee the stability of the newspaper, which is still being published today. This campaign, aimed at defending the rights of Francophones in Ontario, really brought Asselin into the public spotlight in Quebec. And though he was struggling financially, Asselin emerged as one of the most famous journalists in Quebec and became well known for his socialist and nationalist thinking all over the province. As I've been pointing out, Asselin was an independent thinker, and this often led to unexpected twists and turns in his life. In 1915, he made a decision that shocked all of his friends and allies. He was 40 years old and exempt from being conscripted into military service, but he nonetheless volunteered to fight overseas in World War I in the Canadian Army. Many of the French workers who support Asselin saw World War I as a war between German capitalists on the one side and capitalists of the rest of Europe on the other side. They thought that workers would die in the fighting while capitalists stayed safe in their luxurious mansions and watched their profits grow when they sold their goods to feed the war machine. Asselin's nationalist friends were equally opposed to World War I, but for a different reason. They intensely disliked the British monarchy that had colonized and occupied Quebec for 100 years. They didn't see why Francophones from Quebec should go overseas to fight an English king after the way Britain had treated Quebec over many decades. Asselin, for his part, explained that he was actually fighting for France and not England. He said that France had been attacked by the Germans, and he was going to war because France could not fall since it was so important to maintaining French-speaking civilization around the world. The Canadian Army used Asselin to recruit French workers to enlist, and he was placed in charge of the only French-speaking unit in the Canadian Army. He was awarded a medal for his bravery at Vimy Ridge. However, by the time Asselin returned to Montreal in 1919, he had lost all of his fame. He had no job prospects, $15,000 of debt, and most of his friends and former allies now refused to speak to him. He spent the later years of his life writing for various small newspapers and doing social work for charitable organizations who worked with the unhoused and unemployed men of Montreal. In a strange twist of fate, Asselin was recruited in 1930 to be the editor-in-chief of the Liberal Party of Quebec's newspaper called Le Canada. And it was the very Minister of Labour who had slapped in the face over 20 years ago on the floor of the Quebec legislature who recruited him. That Minister of Labour, by the name of Louis-Alexandre Taschereau, was now the Liberal Premier of Quebec and wanted Asselin to assist him in reducing the popularity of Quebec's Conservative Party that seemed poised to take power. Asselin really wanted to get into politics in a big way again, and he really needed the money. But throughout his life, up to that point, he had always denounced the Liberal Party of Quebec. He had always said that the Liberals were never doing enough to reduce the poverty of workers during their time in government. He also denounced the Liberals because they were too afraid, he said, to demand more power from the federal government in Ottawa that could be given to the Quebec provincial government. But As I said, Aslan was proud, and he was an independent thinker, and he decided to go against the grain once again. He decided to accept the position and to use his status as editor of Le Canada to push the Quebec Liberals to the left. He was not particularly successful in this, and the Quebec Liberals actually ended up splitting into a left-wing and right-wing faction in the 1930s.
There's a highlight from a recent episode of the Perspectives podcast. Find out more at perspectivesjournal.ca, at broadbentinstitute.ca, and at harbingermedianetwork.com. You listen to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. I'm Harbinger director Andre Goulet in Montreal. And finally, broadcasting for more than four decades, Red Eye presents a progressive take on current events produced by an independent media collective at Vancouver Co-op Radio. On the segment from a recent episode, First Peoples Law senior partner Bruce McIver explains why his new book, Indigenous Rights in 1 Minute, is essential reading for advancing reconciliation. Now, here's the show.
I'm Jane Williams. This is the Red Eye Podcast. You can hear our live broadcast on Saturday mornings from 10 till noon at 100.5 FM in the Lower Mainland. In this episode, lawyer Bruce McIver joins Lorraine Chisholm to talk about his new book, Indigenous Rights in 1 Minute, What You Need to Know to Talk Reconciliation. Bruce McIver has written a new book that should become essential readings for Canadians who want to advance reconciliation. Indigenous Rights in 1 Minute asks and answers questions like, who qualifies as Métis? And what is the doctrine of discovery? Bruce McIver is the founder and senior partner at First Peoples Law and an adjunct professor at the University of British Columbia's Allard School of Law. He's a member of the Manitoba Métis Federation, and Bruce joins me now. Hello, Bruce.
Hello.
I want to start by expressing my gratitude to you for writing this book. It is truly genius.
Oh, well, that is very kind of you.
Why did you write it?
I wrote it because I get asked those types of questions all the time, and I've been answering them for years, and I thought maybe I should put these into a book so they're more widely available. So that was the basic reason. And then part of my wider work I've been doing for quite a while, which is just trying to make a useful contribution to the national conversation that we have around Indigenous rights and reconciliation. I think there's a lot of misinformation or lack of information out there. So I wrote the book as a small contribution to try to make for a better conversation.
Well, it's definitely going right on my bookshelf where I need to refer to it on a regular basis. So tell us how the book is structured and how you came to this way of presenting the ideas in the book.
Sure. The way I wrote it, and I joke with people, it's meant for someone like me that's got a short attention span, is that I pose each question, I give a one-sentence answer, and then I give about 300 or 350 more words just to answer the question in a bit more depth. So it's not meant to sit down and read from page one to the last page. It's more meant to pick it up. You've got a question or just an interest in Indigenous rights, in reconciliation. You think you could use some more information, or you get comments from colleagues, family members, friends, and you think, you know what, I don't think that's right. So hopefully you can find the information there to help you be part of a better conversation.
Well, let's dive into an example. Page 32. The question, what's the difference between Aboriginal rights and Indigenous rights? What do people need to know about that?
Yeah, that these are very different because Indigenous rights are Indigenous people's inherent rights as being part of an Indigenous nation. And there's many different Indigenous nations across the country, all with their own particular laws and traditions. So those are Indigenous rights. Aboriginal rights are the rights that are recognized specific for Indigenous people under Canadian law. And what's important there is that those rights are rights that fit within the tests and requirements made up by judges within the Canadian law framework, but they're not necessarily the same as, or they don't cover all the Indigenous rights that Indigenous people would have as being a member of their nation.
Now, Bruce, you also highlight and link certain court cases to questions. For instance, why is the Tsilkotin decision important, or why is the Sparrow decision important? What was your purpose in including these sections?
Yeah, with this, I think that as a lawyer, if I can do it, I have a responsibility to try to explain these fundamental cases for non-lawyers. Because to know enough about Indigenous rights to have an informed conversation, it's important to at least have access to reliable information about these court cases, what they stand for, and then what they don't stand for, because there are a lot of comments you will read out in the press where people are expressing their opinions, but they're not really based on what the courts have had to say. So that's why it's important to be there. And it's also important, I think, because then non-lawyers can see how the law is developed. It's really, really important. It's not, and I tell people this a lot, it's not like the tablets given to Moses by God coming down from the mountain. That's not how the law works. Real people acting as judges decide these things. Governments take positions on these issues. The law develops, and the law can develop from at least an Indigenous perspective, in a better direction. And if it's going to do that, I think we need to know more about the fundamentals of the law.
In the answer to the question, how do courts limit the impact of Aboriginal rights? You say Indigenous people fail in court because they present evidence for an Aboriginal right, and then they're told they actually needed to present evidence for a different right. It's as if you say someone presents evidence they saw a chicken only to be later told they needed to prove they saw a specific type of chicken, a Rhode Island red. Talk about this problem.
Yeah, this is a really important part of the difference between Indigenous rights and Aboriginal rights, because Aboriginal rights are what fits within the tests developed by the judges who decide these things in Canadian courts. And the test can be shaped in such a way to limit the effectiveness of the recognition of Aboriginal rights under the Constitution. One of the ways the courts do that is, well, we said you needed to identify this, you did something else, so we're going to decide it this way. It really is frustrating for Indigenous people because it can be a moving target in court where you can see a judge wanting to get to a particular result. And there's enough latitude in how the law works that they can get there and still say, well, I followed the law in this particular situation.
Bruce, one through line in the book, or at least one through line I took from it, is how all these elements are linked in a way by the Canadian project of colonization. Talk about how this is such a significant and persistent motive in Canada.
Yeah, it's really important to understand that colonization is not a historical event. It's something that's going on today, every day in Canada. It's ongoing. It's part of the long-term project of removing Indigenous people from the land so non-Indigenous people can exploit their lands. And we see that particularly across BC all the time. So it's important that it's not historical. It's going on today. We don't call it this most of the time. And in the book, I give the example that one of the discredited principles at the very foundations of colonization is the doctrine of discovery. And we don't call it that in Canada now. We call it the assertion of crown sovereignty. But that's just a euphemism for the same thing that went on 150 years ago and is going on now.
I want to move a bit from the map to the territory here. From your analysis, it seems that the system of proving Aboriginal title in itself puts Indigenous people at risk. You say if they assert their rights, they're criminalized. Can you talk about what that looks like on the ground right now?
Yeah, we see it a lot in BC, probably for a lot of people. They just have to think back to the Wet'suwet'en and the Coastal GasLink project. These rights exist, the rights over the land, the rights to decide how the lands would be used or would not be used. But because provincial and federal governments maintain a policy of denying those rights, it's not that they're asserted rights, they're denied rights. And so it's in the interest of the colonizers to continue to deny them. And then what happens, Canadian law kicks in, there may be opportunities to consult, but there's no requirement to do anything in response to the objections raised by Indigenous people. Then they end up being criminalized. I see this all the time. Land defenders, most often women, being criminalized under Canadian law because they're standing up for their rights that are supposedly protected under the Canadian Constitution. But as long as governments deny them, those land defenders can end up in jail.
There's a new interview from Red Eye. Hear more of their high-quality public affairs and arts programming every Saturday from 10 to noon PST at CFRO 100.5 FM in Vancouver and at harbingermedianetwork.com. You can listen to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. This episode has been brought to you by Unricked. Learn more about Canada's coalition of more than 30 progressive publishers and get all your independent Canadian journalism, including news, videos, and podcasts, in one place at unricked.ca. And by The Alberta Advantage. Find the show's almost 9 years of archived episodes at albertaadvantagepod.com. Follow us on Instagram at Media Harbinger and now on Blue Sky for updates on new episodes. And subscribe to the Harbinger newsletter for a weekly Wednesday roundup from Canada's cross-country community of 83 socially and politically progressive podcasts. We'll be back with a new episode next week. Until then, I'm Harbinger director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Now back to your regularly scheduled community radio station programming.
Listening to CJSF at 90.1 FM in Burnaby. CJSF is diverse, independent, and yours. Share music and voices from genres and cultures around the world, reflecting you and the rest of your community. You make CJSF diverse.
Get ready for Listen Up. The Geography Student Union presents a night of live music starting at 5 p.m. on November 29th at the Student Union Building Ballroom on SFU Burnaby campus, featuring Sleepy Gonzalez, The Lunchtime Band, and Tiger Really. Tickets are $15, available online or at the door while they last. Open to all ages and everyone.